From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The U.S. Supreme Court is back in action. A North Carolina legal expert helps us prepare for the court's current term by looking back at key rulings from the last year. What are the interesting trends? Which justices are working together in surprising ways? The 2016 election cycle introduced America to the term fake news. We'll hear from some national political pundits speaking at a Davidson College event. They worry about ongoing concerns surrounding mainstream media news coverage. The head of North Carolina Emergency Management recently testified on Capitol Hill. You'll hear his suggestions and his answers to pointed questions about federal disaster relief. At least one outsider questions North Carolina's use of federal dollars. And we'll dissect the latest Democratic plans for raising taxes on the rich. Who wants to do it? Does it make sense? What are the unintended consequences? Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
When we talk about 2020 politics, the focus is usually on the presidential election and North Carolina's role as a battleground state. But one statewide race is shaping up to be pretty interesting. At least a dozen people have said that they have plans to run for the lieutenant governor's job. That is, of course, the number two job in state government. Current Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, as we know, is running for governor. The latest person to announce for the lieutenant governor's job is the current superintendent of public instruction. Carolina Journal is following all of these statewide races very closely. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief and joins us now to talk about the latest developments. Hey, Rick.
Hi there.
So Mark Johnson, superintendent of public instruction, says he wants to continue to be an elected official, but he doesn't want to a second term as superintendent.
Yes, and that's somewhat unusual because actually you could consider lieutenant governor to be a demotion from superintendent of public instruction because the lieutenant governor has almost no power in the state. The lieutenant governor has whatever power the General Assembly has given it, and it took most of those powers away when Jim Gardner was lieutenant governor about 30, 40 years ago. And so the lieutenant governor's job is largely symbolic. Now, of course, that person has the ability to serve as an ambassador, to be the acting governor, if the governor's away and things like that. But the superintendent actually has a lot more authority. And so Mark Johnson's decision to do this is somewhat interesting. Now, people may think the lieutenant governor's job has a higher profile and is more important and all that, but in a lot of ways, it really isn't. So it's sort of unusual that Johnson would choose that path rather than another term as superintendent. Then again, his tenure has not sat well with the education establishment and a lot of folks, and so maybe he's thinking that he might have a tough time getting reelected. Who knows?
Interesting. Now, he's not the only one. All sorts of people have decided that they're very interested in this particular seat, and that's curious in that, as you described, not much official power, but is it just that the person in the lieutenant governor's position can kind of fashion whatever job they want?
That has something to do with it. And of course, lieutenant governor has been the stepping stone to governor in several instances, especially when the governor could not succeed him or herself. Now, that's not an issue anymore. But, you did have the situation where Jim Hunt went from lieutenant governor to governor, where Bev Perdue went from lieutenant governor to governor. And Dan Forrest is attempting to make that same step. But yes, it is something. It's largely a position that you can define your own job. It's helpful if the governor is of the same party, because that way you can, and we can talk about that in just a second, but that the governor, when Pat McCrory was governor, he actually gave Dan Forrest a pretty big portfolio of things to do. And so that was useful. I mean, the lieutenant governor also presides over the Senate. And so if indeed we do have an evenly divided Senate or a Senate where there are issues in play, then that vote can be very important. But we have a lot of people who are interested in it. On the Republican side, we have have former representative, U.S. Representative Renee Elmers of the Dunn-Willington area. We've got State Senator Andy Wells of Catawba County and former State Rep Scott Stone interested in the job. And so we've got some big players who are interested in it.
And on the Democratic side, we've got at least five people that we know of who've said they would like this.
Right.
We know that the official filing begins in early December, but several people talking about it, including a couple of state representatives.
Right. And also State Senator Terry Van Dyne from Buncombe County, who had an interesting statement. She was at an event recently in which she said that the role of the lieutenant governor is to essentially amplify the voice of the governor. Well, that's really handy when you're of the same party.
If
you're
not,
I mean, you know, North Carolina is one of those states where the governor and lieutenant governor don't run as a ticket. And so in a lot of those states where the governor and lieutenant governor run as a ticket, the lieutenant governor really is an even more symbolic position than it is in North Carolina. This person is basically a ribbon cutter and a ceremony attender and that type of thing. But Van Dyne's statement was interesting because, for one thing, it shows that the Democrats are very confident that they're going to take the governor's seat again, that Roy Cooper's going to get reelected. But it is an unusual role because the lieutenant governor, you know, basically using the old joke, she's basically saying lieutenant governor's a potted plant. You know, that's just simply somebody there to say, yay, governor, yay, what you're doing, good thing, good thing.
Well, I'll tell you what, if even a handful of the people who've said they're interested in end up actually filing as a candidate, this will be an amazing primary in March to watch for this one.
It absolutely will. And for one thing, it will mean that there will certainly be openings in a number of state legislative seats that aren't there currently. The Renee Elmers role in the statewide race, I mean, it's interesting. I guess it's a strange 6 degrees of separation, but Renee Elmers defeated Bob Etheridge, who was the superintendent of public instruction, and now she's running against the current superintendent of public instruction. So, I mean,
it's a small world.
It's a very small world. Yes.
So, Rick, with Mark Johnson saying, nope, not going to seek a second term as superintendent of public instruction, I'm going to look at the lieutenant governor's race. That has now opened up a whole lot of speculation about, okay, who will file to try to seek the superintendent's job?
Right. And there are two very prominent Republicans who have stepped forward. One is Representative Craig Horn, who's, I believe, from Union County, I think, who's one of the top education policymakers in the General Assembly. Also, Catherine Truitt, who was an advisor to Governor McCrory, but is the chancellor of Western Governors University in North Carolina. Two people who have, I think, somewhat similar views about a lot of issues dealing with educational choice and the like, but have very, very different backgrounds and experience. I mean, that's going to be a very interesting race because you have someone who has a lot of experience in the legislative side with education and someone who has a lot of experience on the administrative side with education. And so, I mean, it's going to be a fascinating race. Chris Malone, former Wake County School Board member, has also said he's interested in running. The only reason he is of interest at all probably is because he is from Wake County and he has been elected from Wake County. But Catherine Truitt lives in Wake County, too. And so that's it. But the Republican race will be very interesting. And on the Democratic side, it's basically going to be let's unravel all the reforms that the Republicans have made in the General Assembly over the past 10 years and go back to having the North Carolina Association of Educators run everything.
You know, this particular position is always fascinating because of the continual strife, it seems, and disagreements about who runs, and I use that word in quotes, who runs education in North Carolina. And so one has to wonder, would it be any different, perhaps, if Roy Cooper, a Democrat, is reelected and a Democrat wins the superintendent's race? Maybe they would be more simpatico on their views about education, but it could just be lining up to be more strife.
Yeah, I mean, it's always possible, but then again, we have to remember that not so long ago, about a decade ago, there was a fight between two Democrats about this, the then Governor Bev Perdue, and the then superintendent, June Atkinson, over who actually controls management of the schools. And it went to court. And the courts actually said that the superintendent is the chief policymaker and the chief administrator for the public school system. Bev Perdue tried to appoint her own education czar and basically take all of Atkinson's authority away. So it's not necessarily something that is a partisan issue, but one of philosophy and of the roles of public schools, private schools, alternative types of schools, alternatives to traditional schools. It's a big issue.
Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Rick, I know that CJ is going to be all over these statewide races, the primaries as well as the general, profiling the candidates, taking a look at the big issues in the races. So we await the official filing. Once we know who's actually in the race, we will look forward to all of that coverage. Rick, where can folks find Carolina Journal and you on Twitter?
CarolinaJournal.com is the web address. I am at Deregulator on Twitter.
Rick, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to CarolinaJournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at CarolinaJournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The return of October means the return to action of the U.S. Supreme Court. What can the court's recent past tell us about its potential future? Well, joining us with some interesting answers to that question is Daniel Gibson. He's an attorney with the Apex-based Stam Law Firm, and he recently discussed the U.S. Supreme Court's 2019 term with the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
In looking at this 2019 term, obviously you were studying it very closely. What are some of the things that stood out most to you?
I think the first thing to note is what I would call the odd majorities of the United States Supreme Court this term. Now, if we were expecting what I would call pure partisanship, which is the five conservative justices always aligning against the four liberal justices, we would have seen a very different term. What actually happened this term was there were 21 5-4 cases, but actually a plurality of those cases, which is 45%, went in sort of a more liberal direction. So what happened was the liberal justices, I think, were crafting opinions to pick off one of the conservative justices to join them. So you'd see four liberals and Roberts, or four liberals and Gorsuch. So instead of getting this partisanship that I think a lot of us were expecting, we actually got much more narrow Supreme Court decisions because the liberals obviously were narrowing the broadness of their holdings to attract an extra justice.
Do you get the sense that there was a concerted effort to do that?
You know, it's hard to say because we'd sort of have to put ourselves in their minds. But I've got to think, if I was a United States Supreme Court justice and the alternative was the five justices that I disagree with getting together and writing a very broad opinion that might, you know, potentially overturn precedent that I care about, or sort of taking a smaller victory over a big loss, I'd take the smaller victory.
In looking at these cases, you mentioned that it's in a number of cases, it was the four justices considered the liberal bloc with one of the members of the so-called conservative bloc. Do you get the sense then that that is against this idea that we have a very strong conservative majority on the court?
I think it's really more against the idea of justices as purely partisan. And what I mean by that is, you know, we think of Republican or conservative justices and Democrat or liberal justices. But really, I think these justices are people that are very well educated in the law and have a consistent judicial philosophy. And a lot of times that's going to yield predictable partisan results. But if someone is a pure originalist in the vein of, say, Justice Thomas or Justice Gorsuch, you might find things that seem liberal, for instance, on criminal defendants' rights, because our Constitution is actually fairly liberal when it comes to the rights of the accused. on the other end of the spectrum, someone that's a pure pragmatist in a liberal judicial philosophy might sometimes give conservative results in cases because those are the results that they actually think are the most pragmatic. So I think it's really more a question of the underlying judicial philosophy than this justice always votes with the conservatives.
We are chatting with Daniel Gibson. He is an attorney with the Stamm Law Firm in Apex, North Carolina, and he's been looking very closely at the 2019 term of the U.S. Supreme Court. When you went through these decisions, did they surprise you, or did you see that even if the outcomes, the 5-4 with the four liberals and one conservative coming together, they actually sort of fit in with what we have seen these justices rule about in the past?
Well, whenever you're dealing with two fairly new justices like Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, sometimes it's hard to say what they're going to turn out to be like. And I think the biggest surprise in this term has actually been Kavanaugh and Gorsuch. Something that's really remarkable about them is they have one of the highest disagreement rates of any two justices appointed by the same president. So that means that a lot of times they're splitting their votes. And that sort of gets back to the partisanship question. I think Gorsuch is very much an originalist, wants to stick to the original meaning of the Constitution, doesn't really care about, changing interpretations of those words. On the other hand, Kavanaugh is more, I think, in the line of, say, a Chief Justice Roberts, that is more concerned about the appearance of the court, having a limited judiciary, things like that. So a lot of the surprises, in my opinion, came from Roberts, Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch. They were the ones that were most likely to split off and give us these sort of more unique cases.
You mentioned Kavanaugh, and it's a good time to remind folks, this is the first term when Kavanaugh actually played a role. Beyond what you've already said, anything else about Kavanaugh that struck you as interesting in his contributions to the court?
It's fairly early to say. He did align a lot with Chief Justice Roberts, which was not something I was expecting. There's always a question of he went through such a embattled domination process. Has that perhaps shifted him in a direction where he wants to give a better appearance to the court? I was expecting Kavanaugh to be more in line with, say, Gorsuch, but obviously that didn't quite turn out the way that we were expecting.
So we have basically one term in hand with this court as it's currently constituted. Any things that you see looking forward that this could mean for the cases that are going to be coming before the court in the 2020 term?
I think something that's really interesting to note about the court is the inaction or relative inaction when it comes to pro-life or pro-choice issues. There have been cases that have come up to the court where they could have potentially taken those and narrowed or overturned Roe v. Wade, and they haven't chosen to do that. I think that that's probably the biggest message moving forward from this court is I think we're not going to see a whole lot of major intervention with this current makeup of the court. Roberts and Kavanaugh are now sort of the swing votes, and I think they're going to act as sort of a ballast for the court, so it's not going to go too far in either way, in either direction.
Given what we saw during the 2019 term, do you expect that there's going to be a lot of action behind the scenes once the new cases get started of the four-member so-called liberal bloc trying to find ways to get at least one of the conservatives on their side as they did in this past term?
I would expect that trend to continue. They're obviously very well-educated, very intelligent people on the Supreme Court. And again, the incentive structure hasn't changed there. I think they still have an incentive to try to write an opinion that can be a small win for them or at least a smaller loss as opposed to a large win for conservatives or a large loss for liberals. So that's a trend that I expect to continue. Of course, I can't see the future, so I could be completely wrong on that.
In the brief time that we have left, does that also mean any sort of change in strategy on the other side, the conservatives, to try to find a way to keep them all together?
If I was a conservative jurist or I was a conservative attorney arguing at the Supreme Court, I would be thinking, what are the issues that I can pick off one of the liberal justices on and maybe turn that 5-4 case into a 6-3 case? You know, maybe we can get Breyer to join the conservatives. You know, crazier things have happened. So, you know, there's always a question of what your strategy and what your tactics are at the Supreme Court. And there's always sort of this game theory. If we do this, they'll do that, so on and so forth. So it should be an interesting term.
Well, one person who will be watching that term very closely is Daniel Gibson. He is an attorney with the Stam Law Firm. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The 2016 election cycle helped generate a new term, fake news. Will the debate about media coverage and fake news play an important role again in 2020? That topic cropped up during a recent event at Davidson College. Longtime conservative pundit Bill Kristol shared his concerns about accurate media information with Mike Allen, co-founder of Axios. Kristol has been a vocal critic of President Trump. He recalls a dinner he had in 2017 with other conservatives who support Trump.
I said, look, Trump's got to be careful. He should expand his base. He lost by 2.5 million votes or so in the popular vote. He can't just assume, you know, he really, if I were he should be reaching out to new voters, not just doubling down on his base. And one of the people said, no, but that's just fake. I mean, there were 3 million votes that were stolen, 3 million illegal votes in California or something like that. And I said, that's really not, they've looked into this pretty carefully, and I can explain even where this misunderstanding comes from, but it's not actually true. Intelligent people, well-educated, successful, nice people, just insisted it was true. And it was, they had seen it online, they had seen it on a Facebook post, it had been circulated on an email, they'd seen it many times on sort of quote news sites. And at some point, you do worry that, I mean, and that's not, there are a million cases of this on right, left, center, but you worry that at what point, you know, how do you ever correct something like that? And how much are we going down a path where there's no authoritative, or not authoritative is not even the right word, but no common source of news or facts or truth? How much do you worry about that?
Ah, it's fine. but I will say the media is complicit in this. So the media has done plenty to undermine your trust in us. So if you look at how we covered 2016, we had one job, and our job was to understand America and explain it to you. And the results of that election made it clear that, like, there was a big hole in our approach. It's so important for us to talk to people who live in all parts of America. In 2016, our biggest mistake was we didn't listen. There were very obviously consequential conversations going on in America, including in my family, that were in our blind spot, and we missed them. And we're not doing that much better this time around. And so, like, that trust was undermined, and the more that reporters from organizations that we grew up trusting, the more that they sort of get sloppy and go on the Twitters and, like, give their opinion, like, it makes people less likely to trust us.
That's Mike Allen, co-founder of Axios and a 20-year veteran of Washington media. He's responding to a question from longtime conservative political pundit Bill Kristol. Their conversation took place during a recent event at Davidson College. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. North Carolina has suffered from multiple rounds of damaging hurricanes in recent years. State officials still haven't spent all the federal aid from the first major hurricane, Matthew, from 2016. That topic cropped up during a recent congressional hearing on Capitol Hill. Mike Sprayberry is North Carolina's Director of Emergency Management. He testified about the funding issues, including those tied to a program called Community Development Block Grants for Disaster Relief.
CDBG-DR has proven to be problematic for us. It was a challenge because we didn't have any experience since the early 2000s, and then at a much there was a much lower amount of funding. Our first allocation was $236.5 million. We are now finally on pace. But the real problem is, I think, is that, you know, it's not authorized. And you have to wait, you know, every time that there's an allocation, there's an appropriation made in Congress. And then there's a press release which heightens the expectations of everybody in the state. We're going to be getting this money, and it's going to be quick. And then we wait it goes silent until we get the Federal Register.
Sprayberry is not sure why the process of issuing a Federal Register takes so long.
It doesn't change that much, the Federal Register. So what they're doing is they're spending an inordinate amount of time writing these Federal Registers when they could just put them on out there. And let's take a look at, you know, the rules for state action plans, too. So we need to compress the time frame. I don't think that we need to move it to another agency. I think HUD's the right place for it. There's a lot of other housing programs there that they can leverage. And I also think that if we think moving it to someplace like FEMA, who is still developing policies for the Disaster Recovery Reform Act, they're a year out from that and still haven't gotten all those policies out, which are laws. There's some issues there.
North Carolina's 7th District Congressman David Rouser responded to Sprayberry's remarks.
We've been through a number of storms together, and it seems like every year it's a new storm, a new day, which leads me to comment. I think you mentioned, the press releases, and I've seen the press releases, of course, in Congress, and have been part of some of those press releases. When Congress appropriates money, and I can tell you that those of us who sign our names to those had no expectation whatsoever that it would take 3 years in some cases to get this money out the door and to the recipients. Can you talk just briefly about how that hinders the recovery effort, particularly in years when you have successive storms?
When we first got the funding for Hurricane Matthew, we didn't have the capacity and we had to build from scratch, and we have since remedied that with our NCOR office. I would tell you that the directives that I give the team at NCOR is that we stop work whenever the storm's actually happening, but as soon as the storm blows out, we continue to march. And so the idea is that no matter if you have successive storms that are affecting additional households, we're continuing to be decisively engaged with the funding that we have for Hurricane Matthew. As you know, sir, we're still waiting for the mitigation funding. There's been an FR for that. We intend to turn in our state action plan to HUD in December. And then we're still waiting for the $336.5 million for Florence, and then whatever we're going to get in the disaster supplemental bill later on after that. What I'm telling you here, sir, is we've got a structure now that's where we can drop the funding into the structure and it continue to move. We're not slowing down at all.
Another congressman had more pointed questions for Sprayberry. Republican Gary Palmer represents a district in Alabama.
One of the issues there was that there were millions of dollars of relief funding that had not gotten to residents from North Carolina. Is that still the case?
Sir, we're now on pace. We've drawn down $27.3 million and have $142.8 million committed. So we've made some significant progress. It's not where we want to be. We want to have all that money out to disaster survivors.
But that's $27 million out of over $150
million? $236.5
million.
So yes, sir.
$27 million from $236
right,
would be $209 million. 3 years after a disaster, I don't know about my colleague from North Carolina, but I can't understand why 3 years after a disaster we're still sitting on over $200 million when there are people in desperate need for it.
That's a great point, sir. And I would tell you that when the money was awarded to us, we didn't have the capacity to basically execute the grant. We didn't have anybody that was trained and that knew how to do it. We changed that now with the stand up of the new North Carolina Office of Recovery and Resiliency with 45 highly trained individuals, and we're able to manage the grant more efficiently and get the money out the door to disaster survivors.
You've had another storm since then, not nearly the impact with Matthew. But again, you just told me you're sitting on $209 million. What's the timeline? I mean, and I'd love to know what the holdup is, because if they've If the money's under the control of the state of North Carolina, I mean, are there still federal regulations that are tying your hands?
I would say that we are working with all the projects to get them out and making sure that we're fully meeting all the eligibility criteria. We've been hit by Matthew, which was our storm of record, then by Florence, which is our new storm of record, right, to be followed by Michael and now Dorian. So a lot of different funding pots and a lot of money going out there. We haven't received the $168 million in mitigation yet. We haven't received the $336 million in Florence money. So we're still working with the Matthew money, and so we're totally focused on that and totally focused on not only just assisting with reconstructions and rehabilitations, but also expanding our portfolio of affordable housing.
Has any of that money been spent on anything other than relief for Hurricane Matthew?
It's Hurricane Matthew only, sir.
Okay, but you're waiting on funding for these other hurricanes, Florence, Michael, and Dorian.
That's Alabama Congressman Gary Palmer. You've heard him grilling North Carolina Emergency Management Director Mike Sprayberry. The topic? The state's use of federal hurricane disaster relief money. Palmer followed his questions by summarizing his concerns.
This is something that really bothers me, is that we fund these projects, the money doesn't get spent, another storm hits, we appropriate more money, and we don't know yet what's been done to mitigate and provide relief from the previous storms. And it sounds like we're piling money on top of money. So I think this might be something we want to take a deeper dive into a little bit later on. I'm not satisfied with the answers that I'm getting. I mean, 3 years after a storm, and there's still over $200 million that hasn't been spent, and there's requests for more money. And this is not just a North Carolina problem. This is going on in other places as well.
That's Alabama Congressman Gary Palmer speaking during a recent hearing of a U.S. House Transportation and Infrastructure Subcommittee. He's responding to comments from North Carolina's Emergency Management Director. The topic, state use of federal hurricane disaster relief money. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Taxes are the talk of politics at all levels of government. Last month here in North Carolina, voters in Charlotte-Mecklenburg voted down a proposed hike in the sales tax. State lawmakers have looked at the franchise tax imposed on businesses, and at least one presidential candidate is rolling out a plan to tax wealth, not just income. Joe Coletti is senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. He's our expert on all fiscal and tax issues, and he's been taking a look at all of this and is here to talk about it. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with the federal level here. So taxing the rich and seems to be an idea that is getting a lot of traction in this country. What do you make of it?
Question of inequality is and mobility is one is the starting point for that, that we take a look around the economy over the past few years and how do we help people at the lower end be able to advance? And unfortunately, sometimes when people look at that, they think that the best way to help somebody at the lower end of the economic spectrum is to penalize people at the upper end of the spectrum. And that's where this starts, is taking is the wrong prescription for potentially the right diagnosis, that if we're an unequal society, then there are problems. But the way that you do it is either by lifting the bottom or cutting down the top, and that's where this all starts, is some jealousy and some envy and some general distrust of how people got their money.
We hear the phrase fair share a lot as well, and the implication there and the belief behind that is that people at the higher ends of the income spectrum are being taxed at a lower rate than people at the low end. What about that?
There's actually the New York Times recently had an op-ed by one of their reporters based on a new book by Emmanuel Saez, who's been writing on inequality for a long time and is an advisor to Elizabeth Warren and has advised Bernie Sanders as well. So this all sound like this is coming together in a way. And they've taken a look at what the tax burden on wealthy people versus the rest of us is. And surprisingly, Matthew Iglesias, who is left of center, writing at Vox.com, took a look at what they did and said, you know, they put a lot of assumptions into this to be able to get to their conclusions about how the rich pay less in taxes than the rest of us do, and pointed to some other work, earlier work by Saez with Thomas Piketty, and some work from folks in the federal government at the Congressional Budget Office that show potentially much higher, much more progressive taxes in the country than what the current research is showing. So it all depends on assumptions. It's likely that the rich, because of tax rates, do pay more, and the federal tax code is more progressive than most people give it credit for.
If someone is wealthy and they've been working all their lives, maybe it's through a business or maybe someone even inherited wealth, is there anything inherently wrong with the fact that they have more than many people do?
No, actually, the best description I've heard of what's wrong with the wealth tax came from a professor at the University of Michigan who said, you know, Daniel Radcliffe, who played Harry Potter in all of those movies, saved his money and his put it aside so that he can work on the movies that he wants to work on, art or whatever else. Johnny Depp has been in countless movies and has gone bankrupt because he couldn't figure out how to use all of that money that he has. And she concluded with, I don't know that I want a system that penalizes Daniel Radcliffe and rewards Johnny Depp. I think that's, you know, if you can get down to that level, most of us are like,
the
wealth tax doesn't make sense. Yeah.
Joe, I like the fact that you write and talk a lot about this issue of helping people, particularly those who are vulnerable, maybe living on the margins, really living paycheck to paycheck. And as someone who grew up poor, I can really relate to that. I remember those times growing up when literally we didn't have any money and we were one of those families, even though, you know, it was a working family. We were the working poor. With my mom and dad, I now know as an adult, we're wondering where was dinner going to come from. So here in North Carolina, there's been an effort with the tax code by state lawmakers to really address that. One way they've done it is with what's called the zero tax bracket or the standard deduction. Help us understand what North Carolina lawmakers have done and how that helps particularly those who are living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, the tax code, starting in 2013, the General Assembly moved it to a flat tax rate, but expanded the standard deduction, as you mentioned, which is the amount of money that you can earn before you start paying a dollar in taxes. And so right now we have a 5% income tax rate, and the standard deduction as signed into law by Governor Cooper will be increasing by another 7.5% in the next year. And that's going to save people money in that. And because it's the first dollar that you earn up to the 20,000th dollar that you earn if you're married filing jointly, that means that $20,000 of your income is tax-free. And so that does allow you to be able to spend more and take care of those basic needs, because that first $20,000 is your basic needs. It's probably a little bit more than $20,000, but it covers that. That gets you ahead of the curve. And then that first dollar that you earn, that $20,000 and first dollar is the effective tax rate on that is relatively small, because it's taking into account all the rest of that. And it makes the tax code, it does make the tax code progressive, which is what folks on the left want, while making sure that the people, by making sure that the people at the bottom end are the most protected.
Joe, I want to make sure that we talk about something that you also have been writing about related to this, the whole issue of taxes. And that is people who want to use punitive taxes to get people to not buy certain products. We've seen that with cigarettes. Soda is now kind of in the crosshairs of a lot of people, and several different cities have imposed what's known as the soda tax. Yeah. We're starting to get some information on whether or not that actually is effective. What have we learned?
For the most part, it is not. In Philadelphia, for some reason, higher taxes have cut down on soda consumption, but most of what these soda taxes have done is raise the prices in cities where they are imposed, and because folks who have less transportation, folks at the lower end of the income scale, can't go out to have less access to places outside of the tax district where they can purchase sodas. Whereas somebody with more money is able to go to Costco, buy cases of it, right, and avoid that excess tax that's there. And it leads to a lot of weird things because of what gets taxed and what doesn't get taxed. Right?
And apparently there are even people who say, well, we can actually go one step further and, quote, solve that problem you just described by having a nationwide tax on soda.
Yeah,
that's
if you can't get people to do what you want in a specific place, then just impose the penalty across everybody.
So there you go. Well, folks, you can read all about these tax issues in Joe Coletti's work for the John Locke Foundation. You'll find that at johnlocke.org. Joe, thanks very much. It's been fun. Appreciate
always
you
glad.
Joining us. That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martin. Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.